Hello all, welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm the editor of Kai Drakonis Books. Kai Drakonis Books is an independent literary press that publishes socially conscious or socially engaged literature. And the God Said of Us is a content channel of Kai Drakonis Books in which, you know, me and a couple buddies, we talk about you know, various works of literature. If you would like a free book from Kai Drakonis Books, just head over to our website, xidraconis.org, and fill out our order a book form, and we will send you the book of your choice for free as a statement against commodification. So today, I'm with my normal partners, Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg. We're going to talk about the word Chris used was harrowing. We're going to be talking about a harrowing novel called A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James. And, you know, I really enjoyed this novel. I only have kind of an inkling of what it's all about, though. So I was thinking, Chris, if you wanted to start off and just tell us, you know, give us your slant on what you think is important in the book, you know, or if that sounds reasonable.
Yeah, sure. I can try to do that. And it's a big book, full of a lot. And it's not only big and full of a lot, but it's full of a lot of conflicting interests, political, personal, and also incomplete. I think that there's some unreliable narration and some incomplete pictures or perspectives that are maybe presented as more authoritative than they actually are. So it's
interesting.
A lot of it is sort of pieced together. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if that's something that like we really need to talk about, but you know,
no, I definitely think we should. I was just going to say that of the few things I'm sure about, I'm pretty sure the novel is commenting in some way about narrative and who should have control of it. But I'm not really sure I'm not really sure what else it's saying. So if you wanted to, you know, just keep on going, it seemed like you had more to say.
Well, I was going to say Alex is maybe a good like focal point for the unreliability of narration, if we do want to talk about that. But so the setting is Jamaica, and the United States, but it is maybe more temporally set than anything. It's broken up into five parts. The first two parts are one day and a subsequent day in December, entirely in Jamaica. And then it jumps a few years. Follows some of the same characters, but expands upon the character list, and then jumps another few years, and then I think jumps again for the fifth part. But the kind of like the focal point temporarily, like it all seems to sort of coil around the attempted assassination of Bob Marley, who in the book is called the Singer. And the first two parts kind of introduce all of the varied interests that are involved or around or just sort of witnessing that moment. And the it's very complicated because we're talking about a basically like a political I don't want to call it civil war, but it's kind of almost like that, right? Where you have the JLP and the PNP in Jamaica, communist and capitalist interests within Jamaica and also outside of Jamaica, supposedly Cuban influence and definitely United States influence in the form of the CIA sort of pushing this conflict that is sort of playing itself out on the streets of Jamaica in gang violence that is truly, truly awful. And ultimately culminating in part two with an assassination attempt on Bob Marley. We jump a few years ahead to follow up on the expansion of these gangs into the United States, and also the sort of like the repercussions of that assassination. There's a witness that we follow as she sort of escapes Jamaica to the United States. And we follow her through the rest of the book. And we also follow the various gangsters who are involved, many of whom die, mostly, almost entirely in terrible ways. We kind of come to a state where, in the end of the book, where it seems like this, this gang violence, this sort of like what was sort of like expanding outward from Jamaica has really entrenched itself into New York, specifically in the form of a ruthless, erudite gangster named Ubi. And
Ube.
And that's kind of where we find ourselves. Ube.
I don't know if that's how you pronounce it.
Well, you guys had the audiobook. You would know better than I would, right? How do they say it in the audiobook?
In the audiobook, it was something like Ube.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I read it as Ube, but
Ube.
In my head, I read it as Ube, but I was aware that that was probably just you know, my own kind of internalized rules about how to pronounce things.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, maybe I don't know if you wanted to do more setup work. This is a little contrary to this is a little off from what you guys had talked about with the ideas about narrative and you know, who gets to tell stories. But I think this is kind of like very basic first level sort of subtext here. This is like what would be in the spark notes if like a college sophomore had to write about this book. You know, this is what they would get from spark notes about what it meant. But there's kind of like a, you know, when you have Ube and his kind of what Ube basically does to New York by establishing the crack trade there and all the kinds of misery that surround it, there's sort of almost like a kind of cross corruption, national sort of return corruption that happens, right? Where, like, you know, the U.S., in the first part of the book, the U.S., obviously, like, the CIA is involved in arming and training some of the people who participate in this kind of hybrid gang war slash civil war. So, you know, there's the kind of the instruments of violence and some of the kind of knowledge of violence comes. But then also the interesting thing about it too is that in addition to the training that comes from the CIA, there's also kind of a cultural framework for violence that's also being exported from America, right? Like, it's notable, I think, that one of the main one of the main gangsters is named Josie Wales, right? He names himself after an American cowboy movie, and
right.
kind of has and the in that first section of the book, all the characters are very steeped in the ways that American cinema kind of portrays and understands violence. So, you know, in the first part of the book, America is importing. The importing kind of the instruments of violence and the infrastructure of violence, so to speak, but then also kind of the cultural infrastructure of violence. And then in the second half of the book, there's sort of a, like the, when I, the, some of the stuff that I read about the book before I went into it talked about the ways that it's about consequences, justice, and it, my assumption going into that was that it would be about kind of consequences and justice happening at an interpersonal level or an individual level, but it's really more about the that same thing also plays out at a social level, right? Where the crack trade and the kind of the a lot of the misery that goes with the crack trade, the way that that's then imported back into the United States kind of echoes that theme of consequence at a much larger level. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Not the most insightful thing you could say about the book, but I think that's, I mean, if to me that seems like the kind of basic geopolitical statement of it, I suppose. I'm trying to think there's a specific argument.
Yeah. There's like a specific cultural artifact that is and I'm trying to think, is it a song or someone in the book, maybe it's Alex, says that every Jamaican learned to sing from the same American song and it's like a or the same like musical or something like that, and that's and it's a Western or something, and that's why you have Shot a Sheriff, Josie Wales, I was just kind of zeroing in on that specific example. I can't remember what it was, though.
But
you have Tony Pavarotti, the unfortunate hitman who Alex kills with a letter opener.
Alex,
in one of my favorite,
I don't know if we established this. Alex Pierce is a journalist who works for Rolling Stone and then The Atlantic, who is present during the assassination and then later tries to write some articles about an event that happens later in the book, just for those who haven't read it.
Alex is an interesting character because he's sort of conscious of this and sort of ridicules this. He wants to be authentically white Jamaican. He wants to not just. He wants to, you know. He's that striving, sort of irritating journalistic voice that enters into a culture and a space that he's not really from or has no real connection to. But insists that his attentiveness will unlock something interesting and real. And he is early on just sort of fixated on this peace concert, the unrest in the area, and correctly is interested. I mean, like he's not wrong in seeing that there's something really incredible happening around him. But he does come away from it having missed. I think he's walking away when the assassins go in to shoot Bob Marley or the singer in this book, and his ultimately he's right there when it happens, but he's not right there in the way that. He always wants to be, he kills Tony Pavarotti with a letter opener. That's one of my favorite scenes in the whole book, actually, is his internal voice, like, careening between kind of like his foot's asleep. Tony Pavarotti's like sitting on his foot and thinks that Alex is asleep in bed still, and Alex is just laying there perfectly still, and his mind is racing. And there's and I think that just jumping off of that into an interesting part of this book, I was curious how you guys took the narration of this book, because it seems like time is very loose in this book, and the character's treatment of time Marlon James really follows them as they careen through memory and in their own sort of like stream of consciousness. And it seems as though like a lot of these chapters, because the structure of the book is it progresses through various first person accounts from the different characters. And there are many characters that kind of a thing that's happening is like, we're often sort of locked into a very like we're like in a very important moment, and the narrator is like jumping around in time, thinking about things and telling the story of what led up to that moment. And you guys are, I think, more widely read. Is that a style, or is that a thing that like other writers do in the same way, or is this sort of distinctively Marlon James in your opinions?
I recall reading a book that Rich Carr sent me to review in the Literature of Oceania review thing that he does. Mm-hmm. And it was called The Burial, in which the main character is this woman, and she births a child who immediately dies. And this happens at the beginning of the novel. Mm-hmm. And the main character, the protagonist, buries the child, and the rest of the book follows the mother as she like performs various outlaw acts in the outback of Australia, but the novel is told from the viewpoint of the dead buried child. So it's like the dead buried child can see everything that's happening, and that's obvious. That's not exactly the same, but it struck me as similar. I had the inkling that, you know, if we're gonna put this into logical or reasonable terms, then the narrator of this book isn't, it sounds like it's like each of the characters, but to me it's got to be a third person omniscient narrator who knows each character's thoughts. Mm-hmm. And to me it seems that the character's thoughts have to be filtered through this narrator who can read everybody's minds, but maybe that's just, I don't
would
know.
That, would that be the, is that the spirit? Dead guy? The dead guy? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you mentioned Chris.
Arthur Jennings or whatever his name is.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to me that two things. First, that Sir Arthur Jennings doesn't come back in like the last third of the novel, right? Sir Arthur Jennings is a dead politician who narrates the first section of the novel. Or not the first section. When I say the first section, I mean like the first maybe 8 or 9 pages. He gives us this very sort of... He gives, in the very beginning of the book, he provides this very sort of dark, melodramatic, surrealist narration about the nature of being newly dead and about his experiences as a ghost. And pops back in here and there. And from a certain kind of structural standpoint, you would expect him to reappear as the closing voice, right? I mean, if I were to have guessed what would happen structurally, that would be classically the most like what I would have learned in you know an MFA program, like his voice should reappear somehow at the end, right? But he doesn't. And there's another interesting effect where this is very subtle, but the last section of the book, the first four sections, each chapter is headed by the name of the narrator to help you keep it straight as a reader. And then in the fifth section, maybe this was less obvious to you guys because you had the audiobook, but in the fifth section, the chapters are just headed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right? The two things kind of happen there, which I wonder if those things intertwine. The first of those is that that section also becomes a little bit more grounded, right? You don't have dead people talking. You don't have you don't have people narrating first person who then die horribly in the middle of their narration. There's a kind of almost a sense of kind of a flattening of loss of a little bit of the magical tone in the beginning. I don't know if maybe that has to do with the shift from Jamaica to New York, that maybe the move something about being in a more grounded rationalist society that kind of changes the narrative voice kind of shifts to reflect that. Maybe I'm overreaching in that thought. The other thing that's interesting too is that, and I feel like this ties a little bit, though I can't quite articulate how, many of the characters who, not many of the characters, but several of the characters in the first part of the novel, most notably the character who begins as Nina Burgess, she switches identities every section, right? The first section she's Nina Burgess, and then she witnesses the, she's a young woman who witnesses the assassination attempt on Bob Marley, and in the second section of the novel is taken on a new name and goes through a string of new names. And each time you have to kind of figure out from context, oh, this new character, quote unquote, is actually this old character under a new name. And it's disorienting partly because you're used to relying on the chapter headings to help identify characters for you, right? To help identify the voices in this sort of confusing profusion of voices. And then in the last section, there's sort of a further undermining of that. But maybe that further undermining is appropriate because by that point, names have kind of ceased to be reliable as a mechanism of identification. That's sort of a jumble of thoughts that seemed like they were going to go together before I started.
Well, and I can... You asked if I read the audio or listened to the audiobook or read the actual book, and I did both actually because
Oh, cool. So
and that's I didn't know how to pronounce Yubi. I went camping over the last couple of days and I didn't want to be walking around in Acadia National Park with headphones, so yeah. I got the Kindle copy of the book for the last two parts, to read for the last two parts. And, so I was able to, in the audiobook, you can hear it's the same voice actor for Nina and, and her, first reincarnation, as a different character or not reincarnation, but when she changes her identity, but not for Millicent. So that was I guess I had that. Kim was the first, right? And
first yeah, it's Kim, then it's Dorcas. Nina Burgess, Dorcas, Kim Clark, Dorcas Palmer, and then Millicent. Something
yeah. So Kim, when she switched to when she became Kim, to protect her identity because she doesn't. She sees the assassination attempt, but most importantly, she sees who.
She sees real, Josie Wales' face.
Josie Wales, yeah, who's just kind of this incredible, monstrous character, who's smart and thoughtful and extraordinarily brutal. And she fears for her life and begins to
reasonably,
to, and changes her name. But I experienced that dislocation very much more pronouncedly when reading the actual text and not listening to it, because Patrick, was it the same? I didn't hear the last.
In the final part. I didn't experience the sense of confusion that you did, Hans, because in each part of the book, no matter what, of the audiobook, the same actor voiced the same character. So even in the part where the beginnings of the chapters are named 1, 2, and 3, it still sounded like Nita Burgess when she read her part. Mm-hmm. And Alex Pierce when she read her part, though. In the final chapter, Dr. Love, in the final part, Dr. Love, you know, has his viewpoint as well, and they didn't do this. You know, you would have thought that when Dr. Love is talking to Josie Wales in his, prison cell that the one actor would have voiced Dr. Love and the actor for Josie Wales would have voiced Josie Wales, but it was just Dr. Love. The guy who did Dr. Love also did Josie Wales in the final part.
That's but actually interesting.
It was interesting. I don't know. It's super interesting, but I still don't really know what the book is all about.
Can I ask about your guys' experience of a specific thing, Bam Bam's sure. death?
It was horrifying.
Yeah.
Poor Bam Bam. 15-year-old kid who freaking sees his parents get murdered. And then Josie Wales just, like, pisses on him and buries him alive. I'm like, I fucking hate Josie Wales. I hope Josie Wales fucking... He didn't deserve to get... He deserved to get burned to death, Anyway. It was horrible.
Well,
it was awful. Poor Bam Bam.
And the first part of the book is... There's sort of a shift in tone, too, where the beginning of the book is... harrowing in a way that it really doesn't stay as it proceeds.
Right. No, I think
which
you, I think
you're
right
on
that.
It could have stayed that for 600 odd pages, but there is just something very, the experience that Bam Bam and there's one other gang member who participates in the assassination who I think is also murdered in first person. Is it Demas? Am I remembering that right?
Yeah. Demas.
The experiences that Bam Bam and Demas have where they, they I don't know so much about Demas, but I'm going to assume. I mean, neither of them really have any way of existing in this world other than to participate in the gangs and the violence around them. And
right.
Both of them, they're it's not like they really want to kill Bob Marley. They're just, you know, kept in a hot shed and fed massive drugs, and then kind of they're not really exercising any level of free will in the moment, you know, and they just have no, they really have no will, they have no agency, they have no choice, they have no power, and then they do, you know, a bad thing and then die horribly. And
yeah.
And ultimately whatever sense of justice or retribution you might have, okay, yeah, Josie Wales gets burned in a prison cell, but, you know, he gets burned in a prison cell after decades of wealth and power, and
right,
is conveniently
yeah.
fed a couple pills beforehand, so he doesn't feel
right.
when he... So there's this kind of... There's this just... That section, Chris, and the lead up to it, you know, there's a certain level of just total, complete misery, abasement, sadness that's never really healed or redeemed, or there's
right.
nothing that can be done to heal or redeem that. And it's a relief to get away from it, but in a certain way, you almost, as a reader, feel bad for feeling that relief, you know. In the second half of the novel, where it kind of turns into almost, I mean, the second half almost has kind of a, it becomes more like a violent black comedy than anything else. It's not shocking in the same way, and it's often quite amusing. And the only characters that suffer in the second half are for the most part bad guys. Or Alex Pierce, I guess, doesn't really deserve to get beat up, but he makes it out okay. He'll be all right. And it's, but you almost, I mean, as a reader, I almost felt a weird kind of guilt at feeling relief in being kind of pulled out of this sort of utter black hole of poverty and misery and sort of moved into a more conventional crime novel. Maybe conventional is the wrong word, but a less, something that functions more like a kind of semi-comical crime novel between where most of the participants are, you know, the people who suffer, you can kind of contextualize as deserving it in some way.
I did notice that. I felt like there was a thankful relieving drop off from this, the black hole that you call it, Hans. Though when Josie Wales goes in and kills everybody in the crack house, that's pretty horrifying too.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. But if nothing else, that's not narrated from the perspective of the people who are dying.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, it's objectively a horrifying event, but the way that it's presented, fortunately, you have this, you're right. Externalized from it.
Right. And I really, you know, I don't know. I really don't even feel, other than to say that I really enjoyed reading the book, you know, despite the fact that it's in many places horrifying. I don't know exactly what to pull out from it. I mean, there's that conversation towards the end where in Soundboy the part called Soundboy Killing, in which you find out that the title of the novel is actually taken from the title of the article that Alex Pierce is writing. And for me, that was a little bit of a like, oh, okay, that makes a little more sense now, because I was like, why the fuck is this book called A Brief History of Seven Killings? Like, 1,000 people get killed, and it's not a brief book.
I was actually trying to count. I was trying to count, like, after the first two or three, I was trying to keep track of, like, because I was counting the only, I was thinking, okay, well, maybe it only counts as one of the seven if it's a first-person narrator who dies while narrating. And there's
right,
two or three of
thought.
Those. And I was also kind of thinking, like, boy, there was almost, as somebody who cared a certain amount for these characters, you know, there was an effect where, like, I was kind of trying to count up to the seven and think, like, every time you get closer to the seven, I was thinking, okay, good. Like, if we can just get to seven and Nina Burgess and Alex Pierce are still alive, that'll be a relief.
Right, yeah, because those are the two characters that you really empathize with and kind of hope make it out.
Right. It's the two characters you empathize with, and that also seem to have some hope of making it out. And they
you
do.
Didn't,
not
you didn't
without great suffering. But.
You didn't empathize with Weeper? I felt...
No, I did empathize with
Weeper
a lot.
I did empathize with Weeper. I did. But, yeah, and that was... I don't know if there's much to be said about this, but what do we make of the... What do we make of the... What do we make of... So in that section, I believe that's the fourth section, there's one of the gangsters. Weeper was involved in the assassination of Marley, right? The attempt?
Yes.
And
the brutal murders of the boys who... And, I mean, he did terrible things.
He's not a super good person, but he still
seems
a little bit more... Yeah, he does. Like,
yeah.
Go on.
Well, it's just interesting that I remember, I don't know if there's much to be made out of it, but it's interesting that Weeper, when he lives in America in the fourth section of the novel, is gay and is kind of struggling to come to terms with his identity as a gay man. And the assassin who ends up killing him, John Kay, is also gay. And both of their narrations are very preoccupied with gay sex and gay lust and gay desire,
right,
in really to a much greater extent than the novel ever really explores or deals with heterosexual lust or desire. There's a very long and explicitly described, really quite effectively described, gay sex scene that Weeper narrates. And I didn't really know what to make of that. It seemed present enough that it should be playing some role beyond just defining the character, right?
Right.
That it should be playing some thematic or structural role, particularly because the kind of two main viewpoint characters of the fourth section were both gay and were both kind of struggling with their identities as gay men. But I don't know that I can articulate what that did. I was almost waiting for it to be a plot device, you know, where like John Kay wouldn't end up killing Weeper because they would fall in love or something. And that probably would not have been, that would be a little too pat for this novel, but.
Yeah, that wouldn't
there's
be good.
There's a little bit of that, though. I mean, like, John, it actually felt, maybe this is because the first half of the book is so dark and gritty, it felt almost, saccharine that John would hold Weeper and kind of comfort him while he died, which is John was sort of surprised that he did it himself. But there was kind of that felt like a sort of a gesture in that direction. I mean, like John John's a psychopath. I mean, like, he doesn't really care.
Right. He kills people. He's a murderer. He's an assassin.
And he has no empathy for these people that he's killed, even though he's so interesting because he's
a super interesting character.
He's funny. He's kind of, he's sort of self-deprecating and also capable and also like clever and sarcastic and openly gay, like in this interesting way that makes you kind of want to root for him. How he stood up to his father was impressive and
you're like, yeah, fuck that guy.
I also made a note. What was it? Was it Super Neon Cox or something like that? Hyper. God, I don't have it in front of me. Was the name?
That
was the name
like
of
a,
the
that
magazine
like
that his father was waving
with,
in his
right.
face? No. Like, where is it? I have it right here.
I don't actually believe that Super Neon Cox appears anywhere in this novel. I think you just
I don't
with that.
It's super.
To, like,
it's
keep
super,
it handy for.
No,
a
I don't recall
no,
Super
no.
Neon Cox being there
super,
either.
Super
but.
Supernova Cox. Was the magazine art issue that his father was waving in his face while belittling him and he lies to Weeper about killing Weeper's partner because Weeper asks if John saw anybody else, which is a kind of a nice thing to do, I guess, and then holds Weeper while he dies, and I guess that's where I felt most explicitly like the difference between part one and part two, and it was like, oh, there's just like this glimmer of humanity here in this otherwise really just terrible cold person. But isn't that kind of like maybe the device that you're talking about? I guess it wasn't a device because Weeper doesn't live. It doesn't actually change anything.
And it also doesn't really explain why we've got two, like, why the focus on an exploration of homosexuality or gayness or you know.
Well, Marlon James was is homosexual and came out.
I was
really
about
late
to Google
after
that.
Leaving
I was
Jamaica.
About to Google that.
What did you say? He after leaving Jamaica, he came out.
Yeah, I think it was really late. This is going off a very just a little bit of, but I believe he came out in an article or a decently like disseminated blog post of some sort, and it was after explicitly after he had left Jamaica, where it was not a not an environment where that he felt safe doing so.
Sure.
But maybe I should actually look that up.
Well, that makes sense. Like it's frequent for an author to be interested in exploring things that are relevant to that author. But it still doesn't quite tell us what function it plays in the novel. And that's what I feel like is happening with this novel. There, I get all these kinds of inklings of what the novel might be doing or whatnot, but it never really quite solidifies. Like I was mentioning earlier, towards the end where Yubei and his posse go to, you know, beat the hell out of Alex Pierce in his apartment, and Yubei makes Alex Pierce read the article that he's writing, and there's this moment where Alex has said something like, "This woman's hair was frayed out as if she had just removed extensions or something like that," and Yubei says, "Well, you can't, you don't have any right, or you don't know what it's like to have a black person's hair." And so I definitely felt like that was a moment too, where we're talking about who should control the narrative, but also in context, I don't know what to make of it. One, because Yubei is a gangster. Like, are we meant to identify with his position? Two, I don't actually, you know, I feel like you, just because you're a white person doesn't mean you can't accurately describe things you've seen.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know. It's just, it's really strange. It's really puzzling.
Did you identify with Josie Wales while he was narrating? Like,
no,
in his sections he has... You didn't feel
I felt like it was an interesting character, but I don't know if we were meant to take his position as our position or the novel's position.
I don't know that we're meant to take anybody's position fully as our position. For the most part, I don't know that the novel has a position, really. I mean, it has a large... It probably has a... The little blurb I gave at the beginning of the podcast about kind of the sort of, you know, we imported a lot of cultural and physical violence to Jamaica, and then they imported some back. That's probably a position. But nobody in the article, nobody in the novel really comes out and mouthpieces that. But the kind of granular questions about, a lot of the granular questions that we're getting into, I don't know if the novel, because it has such a profusion of voices and perspectives, I don't know if it necessarily wants to argue a very particular,
you know,
like the question of Alex, right? The question of Alex, because we've been talking about, well, we haven't necessarily gone into great depth on, but we introduced the idea of stories and control of stories and narrative, and Alex, of course, is this locus for that, and it might be that in certain ways he's you know, he's not perfect as a storyteller, as a messenger, as a record keeper. But I don't know that he's totally illegitimate either, necessarily.
Right.
Or that we would want to, I mean, when Ube is talking to him, there's a way that Ube tries to kind of delegitimize him and cut his role and value down that I don't know, certainly I don't think the novel totally identifies with. But is Alex blameless? No, I don't think he's blameless.
Right, sure,
it's a hard question, and you know, it's a hard question, and I don't know that the novel's interested in making a clear argument on it.
But I don't even know that the novel's interested in asking the question, but not, I don't even know if it's interested in pointing out a direction for the question.
I don't know if it is.
If that makes sense.
I don't think it is.
Anyway, sorry, Chris, go on.
Well, I felt the humanity of each character who was given a chance to speak and tell their story. You know, Josie Wales, it's so difficult to, it's impossible to forgive him for what he's done and what he continues to do. But when you're in his head, you kind of feel his, he has an internal humanity that is part of like his story and gives him a right to tell his own story, even if it is awful. And that kind of felt like, you know, like these people, these kids who are, you know, basically like, Weeper describes them as tools that, you know, like are made to be used and then disposed of. I feel like there's a lot of value being in a lot of value shown in like people like having the ability to tell their own stories, and it's difficult to kind of like get any like consistent thing out of all of that. But I was curious, Patrick, you're the most explicitly political person of the three of us, I'm reasonably sure, and there's a lot to explore in the politics of this
book.
Yeah, fuck
the capitalists.
Did you come away with anything? I know, but I'd say that this book is not very clear on, you know, like there being a real distinction between where the violence is coming from. Like Dr. Love is a force for chaos, and is there a clear like chain of causality that comes from the communists or the capitalists, or is it just, because I had a really hard time following the politics of this book. I couldn't at the end really tell you the difference between the PNP and the JLP and
right,
all the different, is it Manley and Peter Nasser. They were all just big boogeymen.
That was something that I noticed early in the novel, how all the characters seem to be aligned with some type of ideology, but like at least, you know, like Barry DeFlorio is obviously for capitalism, and whoever's on the PNP side is at least nominally for communism, and then, you know, Josie Wales is aligned with the JLP, so he's for capitalism. But like the characters seem to be like tools of ideology. You know, definitely Demas and Bam Bam. Definitely DeFlorio seems that way.
Well,
but
I wonder if there's a difference between, leaving aside DeFlorio, right? If we're just thinking about the Jamaican characters, Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's a, if there's maybe a group you can, if there's a way that you can kind of sort the characters out into being characters who are tools of ideology and characters who use ideology pragmatically as a tool, right? So like characters like
so Josie Whale would be one of those, I would guess.
Well, and Josie Whale's being one of those, or any of the Jamaican characters, maybe you guys got a different sense than I did, but I didn't get a sense that any of the Jamaican characters had any particular investment in communism or capitalism as ideology.
Right.
The politicians didn't, the leaders didn't, the gang members didn't. They all felt like there was a strategic value in aligning themselves with one group or another, and they might endorse a particular ideology for the benefit of some external actor for strategic value. It's not so much with a character like Josie Wales, it's not so much that he is a tool of ideology, it's that he uses ideology to try to manipulate other people for power.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that's a good way of kind of characterizing it, to the point that I think this is just a question that the book raises, but it's not really that interested in you know, kind of pointing a finger towards one or the other. I mean,
I don't think it's interested at all in exploring the merits of capitalism or communism.
Right, absolutely. Like, you could, you know, Josie Wales is like, to me, drug dealing always seemed like, you know, capitalism at its most capitalistic. So, you know, there's certainly that Josie Wales is a capitalist, but, you know, while I think that there are lots of things to say for and against communism in Cuba, Fidel Castro was a notorious homophobe and to the point that he imprisoned gay people and, you know, did some pretty horrible things. So again, it's like, these are contexts that we could bring to this if we really wanted to, but I don't know that the work is necessarily interested in those contexts.
But doesn't it expend some energy with Barry and Bill Adler and this sense of like American involvement? Lewis, I can't remember his last name, who works with Dr. Love. There's this sense that, you know, like there are, like, what do we, the Jamaicans are aware of the ideology as a tool. Are we wondering, Barry seems to want to be super capitalist and to like be a kind of like a stereotypical American like square G-man. Is there anything to, and then Bill Adler is this character who kind of pokes fun at him and seems to be expressing some remorse for being a former agent of America destabilizing nations overseas and making sure that the capitalists come out on top. There seems to be something there, but I didn't know what to do with it myself.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the same thing we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's most interested in power and ways of gaining and maintaining power. And it might be that I'm sure that Marlon James has lots of textured ideas about economics and economic ideology, but the novel itself seems most interested in power, instruments of power, consequences of power. and mm-hmm. at least much more so than it creates a world in which ideology is secondary to power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Ask it.
I don't know if you guys had any sense of there's a very important scene where there's a very important scene in the, I believe, fourth section of the novel where Josie Wales goes into a crack house with two guns and just indiscriminately murders everyone in the crack house.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Why
it's
does
horrifying.
He do that?
Because somebody shot him with a water gun full of piss.
Oh, okay. I missed that chain of connection a little bit.
Okay. Oh, did you?
Well.
Yeah, okay. he Oh, you're fucking with me.
No, I'm not fucking. I'm truly not fucking with you. I had read that, actually. When I read it as being... I must have been, like, in a hurry or something when I read the lead-up to that scene. Like, I wasn't quite tracking all the details, which you can get away with to some extent in some places in this novel and not so much in others.
Right.
And I... My thought was that it was born out of some kind of disgust about what he had created. But it just sounds like he was irritated because somebody shot him with a water gun full of piss. So, okay. Never mind.
I came away with a different. I mean, the water gun full of piss is not great, but he goes there. he goes there extremely frustrated with Weeper, right? Like Weeper is just really, like Weeper is shitting the and part of this is what
was he though? Like
well, it kind of sounds because there's the scene beforehand where. Like, he goes there because Ube is kind of tattling on Weeper.
Yeah. Ube is kind of... We're talking about controlling there, narrative, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but then he goes there, and, like, this kid... He talks to one of the kids who works in at the street level, and the kid's like, oh, yeah, you know, I just got hired, and I'm super competent, and there was this other guy who was kind of fucking up, but Weeper took care of that right away and put me in, and I'm super competent. So the reading I got from that was that actually... Ube was kind of trying to tattle on Weeper, but Weeper was actually running the... Even though he was high on his own supply, he was still running the business very competently.
Yeah.
And that's what I took away as well, Hans.
Okay.
Well,
so
either way, he goes there upset with Weeper. And,
Fair enough.
He's looking for reasons to be upset. You know, like, this is... Like, it feels like... Especially because, like, there's... Weeper is just sort of like watching while this happens, and it feels like Ube, you know, Ube is looking at him in the darkness, and Weeper sees that, and it feels like this is Ube, you know, we talked about controlling the narrative. Ube is controlling the narrative, and
right,
and this is Josie Wales, you know, angry and displeased with how things are going, and also covered in piss, you know. I mean,
it does seem to me to be a moment where Josie Wales is coming in to see how his operation is going, and it, you know, the piss gun is the catalyst. But he's displaying the fact that he is still the dominant figure, right?
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah, it's, you know, get your shit together, and if it isn't together, keep it. And if it is already together, then keep it together. Right. Like you work for me.
I'll kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's back. It comes back to the question of power and ways of asserting and maintaining power.
Right.
And Ube is the one in power there. Like, Josie doesn't understand that, like, this is the beginning of the end for him. Like, Ube is...
Right.
It's less... You said it... One of you said it very well. It's less about the ideology and more about the power. And the power is really in how well you can tap into these grand narratives and also tell the story of what's happening. And Ube does that better than anybody else. And he's able to really seize power because of that.
Yeah, he does seem to be, like, taking over from Josie Wales.
Who is your favorite character?
If I had to pick one character, I don't know if this constitutes favorite exactly. It might just be a question of who didn't get enough exposure relative to their level of interest. If I had to pick one character to read an entire novel from the perspective of, I'd say John Kay.
Yeah, John Kay was super cool.
Not necessarily because he's likable or good, but just because he has a very interesting perspective that received relatively limited space in the novel.
So, do you want to know something really hilarious? Great. That was the first.
I always want to know something great.
He was who Marlon James started writing about when he wrote this book.
Really?
Yep. He was the first. It was about John Kay. I had just read that in an article about this book. Let me see if I can find it.
That is crazy. Like, it was first of, how do you build out from that? If it, because, you know, he's really only kind of like a supporting character.
And he's only a supporting character in about 20% of the novel.
Right. I definitely think that, to answer your question, I don't know if he's my favorite, but I'm definitely super interested in Weepa. I think that.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He's definitely disgusting, but he, like, there's, to me, it's like the difference between him and Josie Wales is that Weepa doesn't really know himself, maybe, and, like, to me, it seems like there's a, in a different scenario, he could have been a better person. If that makes sense. Whereas I'm not sure.
Josie Wales was going to be a sociopath no matter what.
Right, right. Yeah. Like, I feel like Weepa is more representative of, like, the, you know, what Howard Zinn says is the relationship between the victim and the oppressor, and which he says is, you know, basically all victims are. Or rather, all oppressors are also victims at some point, you know. So and so, I thought that was interesting. I thought Weepa was interesting for that reason.
So I found the article. It's from the Guardian when he won the
Booker Man.
Yeah, the Booker Man. And this is going to actually answer a few things that's come up that have come up in this podcast.
Chris, you know what we said about author intention as a way.
Oh yeah, sorry. I'll stop. I'll put this away. No, it's good because we zeroed in on you. Well, here, let me just.
Are we just going to use this to pat ourselves on the back?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Oh, good, let's do it.
Yeah.
To whom though did his story first belong? Could it be Popolo, the gang don who finds his softer side and is punished with deposition? Nina Burgess, the anchor who helped pull James through the whole novel, or the appalling Dr. Love whose shadow lengthens across those mighty 688 pages. James shakes his head. John Kay. He was the first. There's a pause. John Kay is a minor character who figures only in the book's final third. I usually am surprised too, he says. Page 458. First page I wrote. I was writing a totally different kind of novel. The discovery that John Kay was the originating voice casts the novel's trajectory in fresh light. A gay hitman from Chicago, John Kay performs two crucial jobs, one of which is to help Weeper, a gay gangster who has moved to the U.S. from Jamaica, affirm a kind of peace with his sexuality. James laughs when he says that this fourth part was the only one he vetoed his mother from reading, probably because of that sex scene that you talked about. Mm, yeah. When James started writing A Brief History with John Kay as the main character, did he mean to write a gay novel? And he says, yes, it was a gay... he was writing about a gay hitman going through boyfriend troubles, trying to kill somebody.
That would have been a great novel, actually, I think.
I'm just going to take that phrase and put it in... I'm going to take that phrase and Google it, because I'm pretty sure somebody else has written that novel, and I want to...
But, yeah, so you guys picked out that homosexual sort of focus felt like it had its own gravity, and that's because it did. In the conception of the novel, the earliest conception of the novel.
You reading that, I actually feel a little disappointed that it didn't come out more.
Really? Like, he could have expanded on it more?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that could have been an extremely interesting book. Which isn't to say that this, as it is, isn't an extremely interesting book.
Yeah, so I did just Google that phrase, and all I came up with was a bunch of stuff about, I'm gay, is it okay if my boyfriend hits me? So.
Oh my god.
Turns out it's not, for those who were wondering.
Jesus, Hans. Christ.
Yeah, I also feel like a lot of my, my Google banner ads that I get in other websites are going to be kind of weird for a couple weeks, too.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. So you guys like the book?
Yeah, sure. I definitely did.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, it was very good.
It was
very good.
Super enjoyable, I thought. You know, I really like being immersed in other cultures. I think it's super interesting, and this book did that in a way that is pretty rare.
One other thing, this isn't really a discussion point, it's just something that struck me that, Chris, I thought you might, I don't know, I wanted to see if you had some of the same thoughts. Just another work that this resonated with for me. Chris, do you remember the documentary, you sent me a preview for this, and I think we both watched it a few years ago. There was a documentary called The Act of Killing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the things that documentary... for background, it's a documentary about... there was a civil war, something in some ways kind of similar to what is described in this book in Jamaica. Is it Indonesia? Am I remembering that right?
Yes.
In Indonesia, in I think the 60s and 70s, there was sort of like a hybrid gang war civil war. There was a civil war where many of the soldiers and enforcers were gang members, essentially. Street gang members. And this documentary, I won't go into all the stuff that it does, but it's a lot of its interest is in the relationship between violence as depicted and conceptualized by American film and these street thug civil war, you know, these street thugs engaged in a civil war who did something that a lot of people now call genocide. You can argue about how that word is applied there, but I mean, they killed an awful lot of people in a very unpleasant way in the context of a civil war. And the way that this novel engaged in its first section with that same idea, the two works, I thought both, it was interesting, the resonance between the two as far as the idea of how you know, violence and the role of violence in American media are used, interpreted, lived in other cultures.
I think that's a really great connection. And it's, I didn't think about it until this podcast, actually, very explicitly, how it seems the violence that's really like playing itself out in Jamaica is mythologized, I guess, in their choice of names and like in what they, how they describe things, you know, how they think about heroism and violence and manliness. And it's mythologized on that American pop culture, like lattice work that is Also shown in that documentary.
All right. Well, does that wrap us up, do you think?
I think it does. Okay. What do you want to read next, Hans?
Well,
your choice.
My choice for next time is The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt.
Oh.
Oh,
okay. A reread for you.
I picked that. Yeah, well, I've read it a couple times now. I reread it a month or so ago, actually, so I probably won't reread it too much before the podcast. I might just flip
through
it. You
son of a bitch.
There were several reasons that I picked it. One of the reasons I picked it was I have a couple other books I want to read, and I wanted to buy myself time by picking something that I'd already read recently.
Yeah. You're hilarious. You're funny.
Another reason is there's a movie coming out in September, so I thought, you know, the timing was good for that. Just because there's going to be some renewed attention to the book, so from a very pragmatic standpoint, I thought we might get a bit more listenership with that, given the timing. And since my last pick was one of the most obscure things that we've covered on the podcast, I thought I kind of owed it to us to maybe not pick something like Gerald's Party this time. I think I've mentioned this to you, Chris, but in the 5 or 6 years that I've been out of a grad school environment, I think this is the one novel that I have enjoyed more than anything else I've read during that time. So, cool. You know, don't shit on it. Or if you are going to shit on it, just be aware of that going in. I might get
probably. I will get
your favorite anus real out and get ready to shit on my book.
Put in my favorite anus.
Shit on anything.
Eat my hottest hot sauce. All the beans.
Even, no.
Eat your
even,
hottest hot sauce.
Even
and
if
a big
somebody doesn't understand it, they'll just say, I don't get it. It doesn't mean nobody's going to shit on anything.
My only worry is it might not be. Well, I don't know how much analysis it will lend itself to, but I'll try to get some ideas together.
Isn't this the book that you said that changed your mind about gripping fiction?
Yeah,
also being highbrow.
This is the book that changed my mind about whether or not I should look down on people who read things because they want to know what happens next.
Okay. All right, I'm looking, despite this heckling, Hans, I'm actually really looking forward to this. I have wanted to read this, so I'm really excited that you picked it, and I get to pick something else for my choice.
Nice.
Patrick's just happy that his choice is one choice closer now.
Yeah, probably. I love making you guys read what I like.
Yeah.
I feel like it's kind of torturous for you, and I think it's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's awesome torturing you guys.
It's been a mixed bag. It's been a mixed bag.
Which one was the what's the bottom of the bag for you?
Oh geez, the bottom of the bag. Well, it was more interesting than I expected to talk about Revolution of the Ordinary. I really enjoyed making that podcast. And it was probably like good brain exercise. I don't do that kind of theoretical stuff anymore much at all.
But you did not enjoy reading it.
For the most part it definitely felt like a chore. Yeah.
Awesome. That's fantastic. I'm glad that happened to you.
All right. Well, see you guys in a couple weeks.
All right.
See you guys.
Peace out, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.